Good morning. It's 7 a.m. and 66 degrees in Central Park. We'll see a high near 83, and it will be partly cloudy this Thursday, July 22nd, 2021. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial, free speech radio, WBAI New York. I'm Johanna Fernandez. Coming up next, A New Day. July 11th, thousands of people marched in Cuba amid a deep economic crisis caused by the U.S. embargo. The protests were covered widely in the international media, and especially here in the United States, but failed to mention that the U.S. opportunistically escalated its brutal economic blockade against Cuba during the pandemic, in an attempt to cause maximum suffering among the Cuban people and precipitate social upheaval. We'll speak to Liz Oliva Fernandez, an award-winning Cuban journalist and producer, and Reed Lindsay, an award-winning journalist and documentary filmmaker. Both currently work with Belly of the Beast, an innovative new media organization that covers Cuba and U.S.-Cuba relations, and they are on the ground talking to us from Cuba. Stay tuned for headlines.
Like a bird in the sky, how sweet it would be if out my heart I could fly. I'd soar to the sun and look down at the sea.
And this is your update on the COVID-19 pandemic. New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio released a new health order yesterday requiring public hospital employees to be vaccinated or undergo weekly testing. About 42,000 employees work for the city's public hospital network, which includes 11 hospitals and more than 70 city-run health clinics. The new health order, which takes effect on August 2nd, will initially apply to clinic-based staff, which includes doctors, nurses, social workers, custodians, and registrars. This order could lead to a broader mandate that extends to all 300,000 municipal workers, such as first responders, including police officers and firefighters, as well as teachers. The urgency for strong public health guidance has grown amid climbing caseloads driven by the more contagious Delta variant of the coronavirus. The seven-day average of new cases in New York City is now around 600, double the amount from last week. Meanwhile, de Blasio has refused to reinstate an indoor mask requirement for all New Yorkers. And over the past week, thousands of multi-ethnic Iranians have demonstrated in response to Iran's water crisis and power blackouts. These protests, in conjunction with massive strikes by oil workers and strikes in other sectors, highlight the discontent of a large swath of the Iranian population that faces a sanctions-battered economy and a repressive bourgeois regime. Since last Friday, an uprising which started in Iran's oil-rich Khuzestan province over severe water and power shortages has spread to at least 17 cities. The power cuts are reported to be the most widespread power cuts since Iran's war with Iraq in the 1980s. Thousands of demonstrators have taken the streets and organized multiple strikes, sit-ins, intercity road blockages, and demonstrations, chanting anti-government slogans, "Death to the Islamic Republic," and "We are thirsty. We want the regime to fall." Protesters are demanding greater access to water for drinking, for their farmlands, and their cattle. In addition to resource mismanagement by a bourgeois regime, Iranians also bear the brunt of maximum pressure sanctions inflicted by U.S. imperialism. And before we get to our full interview on Cuba with guests Liz Oliva Fernandez and Reed Lindsay, let's take a listen to Vijay Prashad, who brings a perspective rarely heard in the media here in the United States.
A year ago, seven United Nations special rapporteurs released a very important statement which sharply said that the illegal unilateral sanctions policy of the United States government, in other words, the blockade of Cuba, must be suspended, if not totally disbanded. I quote from their statement. They said, "In the pandemic emergency, the lack of will of the U.S. government to suspend sanctions may lead to a higher risk of such suffering in Cuba, a higher risk of suffering than predated the pandemic. This may lead to a higher risk of such suffering in Cuba and other countries targeted by its sanctions. Other countries targeted by its sanctions, 30 other countries at least out of the 193 member states in the United Nations. 30 countries which include Venezuela, which include Nicaragua, which include Iran, which include Zimbabwe, which include Syria, which include Lebanon, and go on and on and on. That is why, friends, that is why about 30 countries have joined together to create the Friends in Defense of the United Nations Charter. What they're asking for is mere adherence by countries like the United States, which are member states of the United Nations. The Friends in Defense of the UN Charter are merely asking for adherence, respect for the UN Charter. The seven rapporteurs, special rapporteurs of the United Nations, say that this is a matter of utmost importance and great urgency. That is why in June of 2021, 184 countries out of 193 put their hands up in the UN General Assembly and voted to send a message to Washington, D.C. to lift the embargo. 184 countries, the vast plurality, a majority of unknown proportions, very few votes in the UN General Assembly are at this level. Meanwhile, President Joe Biden in the United States He campaigned saying that he would reverse at least the 243 coercive measures put in place by Donald Trump. He campaigned on this, but he has not, by a stroke of a pen, reversed those 243 coercive measures. Nor has Mr. Biden returned to the Obama standard, which is at least some opening up between Cuba and the United States. And certainly he is not coming to the point of rationality, which is the end of the embargo. Cuba is not alone. This embargo must end. We stand with the Cuban people. We stand with the Cuban Revolution.
And that was Vijay Prashad, former colleague of mine. We both taught at Trinity College in Hartford, Connecticut. He continues to be a colleague, but we no longer work together, nor does he. I left Trinity, and so did he. He's now working abroad. It's 7:11 a.m. and 66 degrees in Central Park. You're tuned to listener-sponsored WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day. And that was El Cuarto de Tula by Buena Vista Social Club. 11 days ago today, on July 11th, thousands of people marched in Cuba amid a deep economic crisis caused by the U.S. embargo. The protests were covered widely in the international media, and especially here in the U.S., but failed to mention that the U.S. opportunistically escalated its brutal economic blockade against Cuba during the pandemic in an attempt to cause maximum suffering among the Cuban people and precipitate such a social upheaval. The protest began in San Antonio de los Baños, 26 kilometers southwest of Havana, sparked by prolonged and constant power outages. This in the context of shortages of basic products, including medicines, but also a dramatic fall in the purchasing power of wages. At around the same time, the pandemic worsened with the arrival of more contagious coronavirus variants, which put the Cuban healthcare system under strain in several provinces, especially since only 15 to 20% of the population is fully vaccinated. In contrast to what we might hear in the United States, some of the slogans of these protests were, "We want vaccines." Other factors motivating the protests include the following: that for days, counter-revolutionary elements had orchestrated an intense campaign on social media under the slogan #SOSCuba. And as you can imagine, that campaign was certainly orchestrated both on the island and in Florida, where the old ruling class of Cuba, the Batista ruling class, settled after the Cuban Revolution of 1959. When Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel denounced the United States for inciting unrest in the Caribbean nation and called on revolutionaries to take the streets to defend the revolution, thousands responded to the call. To fact-check us this morning and tell us what's going on in the island nation, we welcome folks who are on the ground in Cuba. Liz Oliva Fernandez is an award-winning Cuban journalist and producer with Belly of the Beast. She has won a Gracie Award and was co-winner of a One World Media Award for her work presenting the documentary series The War on Cuba. Apart from her journalism and filmmaking, Liz is a dedicated anti-racist and feminist activist. Reed Lindsay is an award-winning journalist and documentary filmmaker whose work has been published in more than 20 major newspapers and magazines and broadcast on television news networks throughout the world. Reed currently works with Belly of the Beast, an innovative new media organization that covers Cuba and U.S.-Cuba relations. Liz and Reed, welcome to A New Day.
Thank you.
First of all, it's been a minute. We've been trying to set up an interview with Belly of the Beast since God was a boy, or perhaps a girl, or non-gendered. This is a propitious moment for this conversation. Thank you so very much for your patience with A New Day. First, tell us, how are each of you doing? Let's start with Liz.
I'm doing great, thank you. We are working a lot because the situation in Cuba. Right now, everything is in calm. But as you know, there are a lot of information, a lot of news about Cuba in the United States media. There are a lot of liars, too. There is a lot of manipulation about what's happening in Cuba right now. So we have a lot of work to do.
Reed.
Yeah, same. It's funny because I feel like we have not stopped. It's just been intense and stressful. But really on the streets, it's been very calm since July 11th. There really hasn't been anything going on. And when I've said that to people in the U.S., they've been sort of surprised because they say, well, according to the coverage that we're seeing, it seems like there's protests every day. It's not been the case really, since July 11th.
So give us a sense of July 11th. What happened on July 11th? Before we talk about root causes, give us a sense of what was the pulse in the streets, Liz.
I was there, the process that I can watch that day was a lot of people, most of them angry. They were frustrated. You can see all of this. Also, it's not common that Cuban people protest in any way. So this is a kind of surprise for us.
Liz, I'm just getting a note that that Reed has to leave, and you're going to stay with us. So Why don't we switch the order? Reed, tell us everything you know in the next 7 minutes about what you've seen on the ground.
Okay. Well, it's funny. So I was on Sunday in particular, I was at lunch at a friend's house in the neighborhood of Regla, and actually was communicating with Liz because we had a day off. It was Sunday. We tried to take a day off on that day. And suddenly we were in our WhatsApp group with all the Belly of the Beast team. People, we started sharing information we were receiving about a protest happening in different parts of the country. Just to back up a few days, in the previous days to that, there had been this social media campaign called SOS Cuba, because for the first time in a year and a half, Cuba really was facing a crisis in terms of its COVID response. In particular, in the province of Matanzas, right near Havana, the rates were going up very high. There were a lot of sick people. Now, keep in mind, Cuba's a very poor country. Its COVID rates, even with this crisis, are five times less than that of the United States. That's the COVID incidence rate. Five times fewer people have gotten COVID in Cuba than in the U.S. Per capita. And the mortality rate, that is, if you get COVID, what are your chances of dying from COVID, is three times less. You're three times less likely to die of COVID in Cuba than in the United States. So overall, their response has been pretty incredible, considering that it's a very poor country. Yeah. But just as they start to be, as they've been rolling out two of the top five vaccines in the world, which they produced in Cuba, another sort of remarkable fact, and all of Havana is getting vaccinated. In fact, I may have to leave early because I'm supposed to be getting my third and final vaccination here in the next half hour. Just as that was happening, the rates started to, the COVID cases started to explode in the provinces where the vaccine hasn't gotten yet. They focus the vaccines in Havana, not in the provinces, because Havana is actually where COVID cases were the worst. So Matanzas started blowing up. And people were very concerned. In fact, Liz came to me the week before and said, you know, we're gathering donations to send to Matanzas. So everyone in Cuba was concerned. But there was this massive social media campaign which went far beyond Cuba. And it was strange. I remember asking about it because people like Mia Khalifa, who was a porn actress, was tweeting about it, and all sorts of random people. And it was taking on this strange viral character, which seemed odd and disproportionate. And we were all sort of wondering about that. And then suddenly on Sunday, protests started happening across Cuba. I heard about it. And then one member of the team said, hey, there's something happening in Bregla. And I was in Bregla. So I ran out to see what was happening. And there were about 150 people in the street. And that was shocking to see because it just doesn't happen in Cuba. And
protesting, you mean?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I started following the march around, and within maybe 30 minutes, it doubled in size. And I've been feeling for many months now that Cuba is a tinderbox waiting to explode because the economic situation is so bad. And I've seen something similar happen in other places like Haiti and Egypt, where economic conditions get so bad that and people are so desperate and frustrated and angry that at some point it just takes a spark to light it on fire and for people to take the street. And I felt like that could happen, and it started to happen. And I thought, wow, are there going to be 10,000 people here in a few minutes? It didn't happen in Bregla. it stayed around 300-400 people. They marched around. The police didn't do anything. It was very peaceful for 3 or 4 hours. Nothing really happened. They even marched to the police station and taunted police officers. They were chanting things that were political, like libertad, freedom, down with communism, insulting the president, and those type of things. But really, the reason people were in the streets, and when we talked to them, it was about economic conditions, it was about not having access to medicine, scarcity, really the economic crisis and scarcities, which the U.S. sanctions have played a huge role in causing. I actually, after that, went and met up with Liz in the downtown, and it was different there, because there in the downtown, there were confrontations with the police, there was violence. There was repression. There's no reason to sugarcoat that. The Cuban police is repressive, and just like any police force in the world, there were some beatings in the street and a lot of arrests that occur that we witnessed, or detentions, I would say, that and many of them were arrests because people have been charged and people are being sentenced now. And some people not always arrested for necessarily doing anything violent. So that is occurring. Don't want to gloss that over. But on the other hand, having been in a lot of protests around the world and seen a lot of police responses, it was not nearly as severe as what I've generally seen, including the United States. There's no tear gas. There's no rubber bullets. I didn't see anyone shot. Anyone killed. There was reportedly somebody killed the next day, but in circumstances that are very unclear, and it's not clear at all that that was a peaceful protest. So that's sort of a picture of what, and since then it's been calm. A lot has been made about internet being cut. Well, we're talking on internet right now. The internet was cut, but it's back and has been back for a while and is pretty much functioning normally. So
were there counter protests? Tell us about the counter protests, the protests that were called by the president.
There were counter protests. They were not as large that day. I'd say maybe 10% the size. There were some clashes, nothing that serious, but between the one side and the other. Keep in mind, the government was very sort of caught off guard, and pro-government people were caught off guard by this. So it's not surprising that they were much smaller. And also sort of, I would say the momentum is very much on the side of people who are angry at the government because the situation is so bad. And I think purpose of the embargo is to make people really angry at their own government. That was written essentially in a State Department memorandum before they made the embargo. We know that's why the embargo was created. And so people are angry. Whatever the causes are, the people who are angry and frustrated are directing that anger at the government. There was a large pro-government demonstration a few days later that was more of like a march, a rally, where Díaz-Canel spoke and Gerardo Hernández was one of the five spoke. And there were many more people in that demonstration than there were in the protests. I would say tens of thousands. The protests in Havana, we saw maybe 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000. It's hard to know exactly. There were protests in other parts of the country. I would say in total, I'd put the number at thousands who protested across the country. If I had to guess, there's no way of knowing for sure. No. The demo in Havana I think it was Saturday, was tens of thousands, but a very different nature.
These are pro-revolution.
Pro-revolution
protests or...
Yeah, but it's different. It's a little different because one was the initial ones, while the spark may have been engineered, we don't know. A lot of people joined just because out of frustration in a spontaneous way. The pro-government protest, it tends to be more organized. Like, let's face it, this most of the institutions and organizations here are state run. It's very organized. It's sort of disciplined. It's a little top down. And so, people, their places of work, they're called out to protest. A lot of people genuinely want to go and they participate in that. My neighbor went. She was excited. She felt like it was important to do. She's very pro-revolutionary. Some people just, are along for the ride. That might be true with the anti-government protest as well, with people just angry and frustrated and they just join because they're pissed off and there's nothing else to do. There's not necessarily a political intention behind it.
Yeah.
And can you tell us, and you have to go in a minute, can you tell us the size of these protests against the conditions in Cuba, if not the government in every instance. Can you give us a sense of the character and size especially, and were they across the country?
They were not. So they were across the country. They were in different cities, but not necessarily every city or every town. They were, I would say, in Havana, for example, localized. I drove around on Sunday, July 11th, all day, well, from Regla into the downtown. I covered a lot of ground, and it was, you had no idea there was protest. It was calm and normal and peaceful. So it was like a very specific locations. There were, so I identified in Havana two places, basically, where people, where the protests had converged. And one was Regla, and they marched to another neighborhood. And I thought, oh my God, they're going to join up with another protest there. Because I've seen that occur in other places in the world, but there wasn't another protest there. It was just the one sort of marching around. And in Havana, there was another one. And that, again, at Regla, 3,400, Havana, 3,400 is my guess, total. And the rest of the country, I don't know how big they were. I imagine they were smaller. There's one more thing that maybe before I go, I could say, because you had mentioned vaccines. In recent days, the Biden administration has made a response, which is basically they're going to continue the Trump policy of tight sanctions. It's also, they've also said that they want to help Cuba by sending Cuba vaccines, first of all. Number two, by giving Cubans internet. And number three, by finding a way to get remittances to Cubans that in a way that doesn't pass through the government's hands. Because in the past, you could send money to Cuba through Western Union. And since all the financial institutions in Cuba are state run, it would go through the state, obviously, and they take a small percentage. This is normal. And Trump stopped that, and Biden promised to bring it back. But now with the protests, he's basically been pressured to continue Trump's policy, and he still wants to keep his promise, but he's going to try to figure out a way to get the money here some other way. Those three offers to help Cuba are completely absurd. First of all, Cuba is vaccinating people right now at a faster rate than almost any country in the world. 30% of the population is vaccinated. I'm getting my third dose today, as I mentioned, and all of Havana will be vaccinated by the end of this month. They produce two of the top five vaccines in the world, and they are rapidly producing more. The reason more people have not been vaccinated, according to BioCuba Pharma, we just interviewed their top biotech company here a couple of days ago, is that the first vaccine they produced, Soberana, which means sovereignty, production was delayed for several months because they could not get raw materials they needed to produce that vaccine because a company in Europe essentially that was providing the vaccine stopped providing the vaccine because of the U.S. embargo, because of sanctions. Now, as far as the internet, humans have internet. They don't need internet. It's crazy that they're putting all this time and effort into like giving Cubans internet. Well, Cubans have internet. Did the government cut it? Yes. Generally, people were able to access it shortly after through VPNs. VPN is like a proxy server. So it's a way to like, if you're in Cuba, it looks like you're connecting from a different country. Mm-hmm. The irony is the reason I have a VPN and everyone on my team has one and a lot of people do is that there's so many websites that are blocked in Cuba because of the U.S. embargo. Like we do video, so we can't access WeTransfer. I can't access Adobe. Zoom, like go down the list. All of those things are blocked by the embargo. You need a VPN to access them. Now, in this case, it was used for a different reason, but basically Cubans have internet. So that's just insane that they're putting all the time and effort into that. And finally, the remittances. The thing is, people are getting remittances here through the black market, because if you're in Miami and you want to send money to a family member, you give them $150 and they take $50 commission and they bring $100 to the person here. And so the money is getting here through basically avoiding the government. But in the past, you'd spend $115 through the person in Miami, through a Western Union, and the person would get $100. In other words, there's already a way that's circumventing the Cuban government. And they've created this false narrative that the Cuban government is just enriching itself off these remittances. It's not. It's just taking a standard fee for processing transactions, which is normal, probably to cover its costs and maybe make an extra money. But we're not talking billions of dollars here. So it's absolutely the disconnect of what the Biden administration is talking about, what the media is covering, and the reality here is enormous.
Reed, you got to go, although Cuba time is not operable here for the vaccine. It's going to happen at 8 o'clock sharp, your vaccine? I'm kidding. You should go. You should
go. I do. In fact, I was getting a call while I was talking from someone who's holding a place in line for me, which if I lose, I might have a very long wait. I'll get it, but I have too much work to do. We have to get the vaccine early today.
Absolutely. Reed, Lindsay, thank you so very much for joining us. Go ahead.
Thank you, and I really appreciate it, John. And I think that you'll have Liz. I'm very glad you'll be able to talk to Liz because she has so much incredible insight to give.
Thank you. Absolutely. And we'll have you back. We can invite you back so we can talk more generally about your work.
Thank you.
Good luck. You've been listening to Reed Lindsay, who's an award-winning journalist and documentary filmmaker whose work has been published in more than 20 major newspapers and magazines and broadcast on television news networks throughout the world. Reed currently works with Belly of the Beast, an innovative new media organization that covers Cuba and U.S.-Cuba relations, and he's off now to get vaccinated in Cuba. And I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day. You're listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York. And we remain with Liz Oliva Fernandez, who is a colleague of Reed's. And we're going to continue this conversation about the uprisings in Cuba and the conditions under which Cubans are living as a result of the decades-long horrific U.S. embargo against Cuba. Liz, is there anything you'd like to add to what you heard Reed share with us?
No, he is amazing. He is pretty much everything. But I want to add that it's hard for Cubans to blame someone else to the government because they blockade the sanctions. They can't see the sanctions. They can't see the blockade. They only feel the effects of the blockade. They need to fall someone else. So they blame the Cuban government because Cuban government is the face of the economic crisis that Cubans are living right now. So because you don't see also the way the sanctions works is through the macro economy. The people don't see the big picture of that, only the small one. For example, the lack of food or the shortages of food or medicines. Cuban people only need, for example, I have a lot of friends that have they have childs and they are like crazy about the food, about take care of my child, don't get sick, because we don't have enough medicines for that. Cuban government say all the time, blockade kill people. The blockade is the big human rights violation that a government can play. I say, why? Why blockade kill people? And I understand now, because I have a big understanding of what's how the blockade works. Because if you don't have the medicines that you need, if you don't have the access, or if you don't have the tools to improve your healthcare system, maybe you can die. And this is reality that Cubans are facing right now.
Now, Liz, what we know about the Cuban Revolution is that it created a world-class health system, but also a world-class educational system. And part of what you're suggesting is that many Cubans are not aware of the way the blockade works. Hasn't there been an educational campaign steered by the government to educate the Cuban people about the blockade?
Well, the Cuban government has failed in the way that they explain the blockade to us. The blockade for Cubans, the blockade is the bigger excuse for Cuban government fails.
For Cuban
that's
government.
Not true.
Say that again. Say that again.
The Cuban people say that, or think that, well, some of them, that the blockade is the excuse that the government give to us to cover her misunderstanding of the economy or something like that. Has their fails. Their fails. It is funny because the blockade is true and is there and affect us, but the government has failed in the way that they explain to us how the blockade works. I don't know if I clear myself because it's complicated, but for example, the documentary Syria, the war in Cuba, was created for a United States audience. But at the same time, I have the commitment that this kind of material has to be useful for Cuban people too. Because I have a lot of friends that say, when they watch the war in Cuba, they say, wow, I didn't know that. And the reason, because they don't do, didn't know that, is because the Cuban government haven't explained that to them. Because they mention and they talk the blockade of something like, is no, I don't know how to say that in English. They talk about the blockade with it's the kind of God, but bad God that is in everywhere and affect to all of us. But they don't explain why and how
the details.
The details. They lose the details. And I think that the best way to talk about the blockade is through life stories. Because you can see in this how affect the blockade one person in a specific way. Also, all the Cubans in the country and outside the country are affecting by the blockade, but not all of us are affecting in the same way because the blockade affects us more or less depending of your sex or your depending of your
gender,
depending of your gender, depending of your race, depending of your educational level, depending of your class, social class. For example, if you are Black women and a woman, is more probably that you are more affected by the blockade than someone who lives, for example, in a downtown and is white, because this is a kind of because in your position, in the position of a Black and poor person, you are more likely to suffer the scarcity than someone is white living downtown and have a relative in the United States and send money.
Huh. Okay, so we're getting into that critical theory territory. I mean, I don't know if you're aware of these critical theory debates here in the United States, which attempt to understand inequality by filtering the situation through the categories of gender and race. And by the way, Liz, if there's a word that you don't remember, you can say it in Spanish. I speak Spanish and I can translate for you.
Okay,
no problem.
Thank you.
So we appreciate the time.
I'm sorry for my English.
No, it's we understand you. It's perfect. And I just want to remind our listening audience that they're listening to the voice of Liz Olivia Fernandez. And we're talking about recent protests in Cuba and how we in the United States might understand the developments in the island nation differently by considering the impact that the blockade has had on the island nation. I'm Johanna Fernandez, your host of A New Day, and you're listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York, and we're going to take calls. The number to call is 212-209-2877. Once again, that number is 212-209-2877. 212-209-2877 is the number to call. Liz Olivia Fernandez is Cuban and on the ground in the island nation. And she was talking to us and tell us more about the politics of race and gender and class. So you mentioned that white Cubans could live downtown in part because they're connected to the old Batista ruling class that sends the money. Tell us more about the conditions of black people and black women in Cuba.
Well, sometimes it's harder for me to talk about this because I have to explain the complexities, the context. It's really a bizarre situation because I was talking with a lot of people around the world and they don't know something similar like Cuba. It's funny because I'm a black woman. I don't live in downtown. I live outside of the city in a marginalized place. And I have a university degree. In that place, as you can find all kind of, because here in Cuba, the education is free for everybody. But depending of your context, is more likely or not that kind of place that they have a lot of marginalized citizens. A lot of people that were in July 11 was black because they are one of the most communities that suffer the scarcity and that suffer the economic crisis. Isn't different than the United States? I don't know how to explain that. It's a kind of in that kind of places you can find someone that go to a school, maybe you can find that your neighbor doesn't have he has the same opportunity than you, but he has to start to work early because he has like more brothers and sisters. They have to work early because they have to help her mom because it's a single mom with take care of the rest of the siblings. Or something similar.
And probably have to travel farther to go to school or to work.
What? Sorry?
And probably have to travel farther, travel yeah. more to get to school or to work.
Yeah. Also, there are black people in Cuba, the most of black people in Cuba work for the sectors that have lower incomes. Or something. I don't know how if I say
yes,
correct.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, it's because there's a racism. Because when the revolution came to the power in 1959, they had a lot of work to eliminate the segregation and inequality in the country. And they have a lot of policies that help people as my family. And at the same time, in some moment, that kind of it's hard because the racism is structural. I don't know how is that correct?
Yes, word? Absolutely structural. Yes.
Yeah, they did a lot of work trying to get up, but nowadays we have to doing. That work, we have to keep in doing a lot of work to eliminate the racism in Cuba. But at the same time, for example, I watched US news and it's a kind of frustrating for me because I have to see how a lot of media that are from the right is manipulating the truth. They are using the angry and the frustration that Black people to support their theories that the United States have to keep the sanctions against Cuba, the sanctions that at the end affect them, the same that are frustrated and angry on the streets. And it's like so hypocritical and cynical, I think so.
Liz,
it's hard to see.
We've got some callers. Let's take these callers. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the line.
Good morning, Joanna. And good morning to the beautiful guests. Cuba is suffering from, I'm from Haiti. I'm Jocelyn. Cuba is suffering from everything that the U.S. empire does everywhere around the world. They whenever there is a leadership that wants to feed their people, give them a place to sleep safely, give them health care and education, they're the enemy. So whenever the U.S. calls somebody a dictator or somebody else, I'm for that person. And there's nowhere the U.S. has gone on this planet where the people's situation has gotten better. I keep on asking that. Give me one example. Nobody is able to give me an example. I've gone to Cuba, and I've seen the contrast between going to San Francisco and going to Cuba. I didn't see anybody in the street sleeping all over the street. They don't have big buildings and luxury, and who needs them anyway, because people commit suicide in front of, I mean, while they have a lot of junk, okay, because that doesn't give you hug, kisses, or anything else. So I've seen the humanity there. People are treated like they matter. So that for me was a difference. And as far as the medicine is concerned, I have a son who suffers from a rare disease. With all the technology that the U.S. has, they cannot heal him. While Cuba has done research on that, and I wanted to go there, but the idiot that was the president of the U.S. before that put the blockade back on, and Biden is continuing it, so I cannot go there to look for treatment. I had contacted them, and they were ready to receive me. So no place on this planet is totally free of problems. If you find some place like this, tell me. But it's better than what's going on in my country right now.
Jocelyn, thank you so very much for sharing your story with us. And we hope that you can take your son eventually to Cuba. We're going to take another call. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from. Caller, you're on the line. Yes, you're on the line, sir. Please raise your voice.
My name is Cliff.
Cliff, welcome. Speak louder.
My name is Cliff. I'm calling from New Jersey.
Welcome.
And I want to commend you on your fantastic program yesterday. And also
Yay.
Your program you did on your conversations with Gary Noel, excellent programs. You're doing a wonderful program today. Keep up the fantastic work you're doing. Thank you for being who you are. You are my radio AOC.
Ha ha! Thank you so very much. Thank you for joining us. And I'm wondering if we've got another call. Caller, you're on the line. Tell us your name and where you're calling from. Okay, we're gonna give it back to you, Liz. So your response to Jocelyn.
Well, it's true. Never country is so sweet or is the heaven of the hell. I think Cuba is able. Well, Cuban people is able to do great things. I think that Cuba set an example that if we are a poor country, if we are a country lack of resources, and we don't have anything else but ourselves, Cuban people, that we have an incredible citizens. If we are able to achieve a lot of, for example, this kind of education for free, healthcare for free, I think that more countries in the world that have more resources or are more,
are less free.
Yeah, the more countries that have more resources, economic resources, are able to do the same, and they don't do it. And I think, why? Mm-hmm. Why Cuba bid for this kind of system and another that are more able to? Because it's, I love my country. I'm very proud of being a Cuban. Because it's really into me that when I'm able to send doctors around the world for free, the most of the cases, we are able to help people to other countries in their fights. And we are able to educate a lot of students that want to be a doctor, and it's impossible because it's really expensive in their own country. So they came to Cuba to do that for free. And we can do that. This is the kind of Cuba that I want. This is the kind of Cuba that I bet. Of course, we have a lot of problems to be in charge and to face it and to confront our government for that. But the sanctions don't help us. The sanctions all hurt Cuban people and only get our life harder and tough that more than now. So when someone in the United States asked me, what you need, what I can do for Cubans, I say to your country that get out of my mind, say to country the end the blockade, say to to pull someone in the government that represents you that enough is enough. It's almost 60 years of the blockade.
Liz, we have to end the show, but we are going to invite you back. Perhaps we can open up the lines earlier. Thank you so very much for your work. You've been listening to the voice of Liz Olivia Fernandez, who is on the ground in Cuba. She's an award-winning Cuban journalist and producer with Belly of the Beast. And essentially, the Cuban Revolution establishes a different standard for humanity, one in which human need is prioritized over profit. You've been listening to non-commercial, listener-funded community radio, WBAI, at 99.5 FM in New York. It's 7:58 and 66 degrees in Central Park this morning, Thursday, July 22nd, 2021. This show is produced by Ajamo Sankofa, Ellis Maxwell, Marcos Maldonado Cruz, Arushi Mohan, and Christina Bassi. Michael G. Haskins is our board operator. We leave you with Hasta Siempre Comandante by Carlos Puebla. I'm your host, Johanna Fernandez. See you tomorrow.
And you're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI, and WBAI.org on the web.